This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho, featuring inspirational and fascinating personal stories of people from all corners of the globe who are now in St. Louis. We'll take a look at the U.S. through newcomers' eyes, get some insight into world history and cultures, and maybe learn something about ourselves. Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Welcome back to Stories of New Americans. Tonight I'm joined by Helen Turner, who is from England originally. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
And usually with these, a lot of these interviews, I kind of set the scene with the guest and ask him or her to tell us where the country is located on the map because, you know, not everybody knows some of these countries that we're talking with people from. But I think people are familiar with England, at least where it is on the map. And, you know, the United States and the UK, it's sometimes called the special relationship between the two countries. So I wanted to just jump right into your story, your childhood, and then we're going to talk more about some more general things. But where in England were you born? What area? What city?
Well, sure. I was born at the Royal Berkshire Hospital in Reading, but I lived in a very small town called Southend Bradfield. And when I say small, I mean very small. There's not a stop sign. There's not a traffic light. There's not lights on the road.
Really?
It's incredibly small.
Like less than 500 people
or
something?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a very small village, but it's beautiful. It's in the south of France. The south of England. It's about 50 miles out of London.
Okay, is it close to the shore?
No, it's right around like the Oxfordshire, Berkshire
okay.
area.
Okay,
yeah, but it's very beautiful and idyllic. When you think of England, that's what it looks like.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
What was your childhood like when you were living there before you came here? You I guess there was a primary school mm-hmm. in the village that you attended.
Yeah,
what was
it
that
was.
Like?
Truly, it was really very idyllic. I had a really lovely childhood. Again, I'm from a really small village, so I went to a very small school. It was actually a Victorian school.
Victorian?
Yes.
You mean Victorian era building?
Or? Yes.
Wow.
So a real historic building. We had like one of those big bells to call
uh-huh.
everybody to lunch that
uh-huh.
you know you could get a chance to ring it and it really was just beautiful.
Wow.
And my childhood was simple and lovely and full of country charm.
Oh.
Lots of bike riding and walking in the woods and picking berries and farming. And, at the end of my road, there were horses. It was just a really lovely childhood.
How could you leave that to come here?
I know. That's what I said to my parents.
And then the school, I guess it was a pretty small school, too. I mean, it was a big building, but it was not a lot of students, I guess, right?
Very small. There were 12 students in my class.
12 students?
Yeah. Yeah, very, very small.
And
we all had known each other for our whole lives.
Wow. Primary school, that would be like mm-hmm.
Up to sixth grade.
Sixth grade,
yep.
Okay.
And then we all would go on to secondary school.
Okay. And then what – you said it was an idyllic childhood mm-hmm. in the area. What kind of things did kids do for fun? Did you play soccer? Was music a big thing there?
Yeah, I don't remember any organized sports. But I was also sporty.
When the kids were playing outside, what did they do?
We would be in the fields.
In the woods.
We'd be walking around.
Yeah.
We would ride our bikes up and down. The close where we live, so close is, I think, called a cul-de-sac.
Oh.
So we would ride our bikes up and down the cul-de-sac mm. and, you know, hang over. And there were horses and a donkey at the end of my road. So it was the big fun thing to climb over the fence and feed the donkey and get in trouble with my parents. But lots of walks in the woods or playing in a stream, you know, putting a stick in one end and watching it go under a bridge and who's won.
Who won? Yeah, which stick went faster? Yeah.
But very little technology.
Yeah.
And we were just outside all the time.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it was really nice.
Did you go to London often?
No. Actually, the first time I went to London was when I was already living in the United States.
Oh.
And we had to go back to get our visa mm-hmm. approved in a U.S. embassy. So we went to London.
Okay.
And that was my first time with my parents.
I wow.
was maybe 13.
Okay. You came here. I didn't realize you came here this young, but you mm-hmm. were 10 when you came here,
you said.
10 How did
years
that
old.
Come about?
So my dad was in finance for Yellow Book. Let your fingers do the walking.
Yeah,
and,
is that still around? Is that still a thing?
No, they've changed company names, but when I was growing up, it was all about Yellow Book. And I remember I came home from, in England we call it brownies, you would call it Girl Scouts.
We
came
have
home
brownies
from a,
here too.
Yeah, oh yeah, a trip. And my dad got this phone call that we were going to go to the United States for 18 months while he helped build out their financial team in New York.
New York.
And I remember when my parents told me, and I was so upset because I had a field trip coming up in the fifth grade.
Oh.
And I really wanted to go. It was like an outdoor adventure field trip.
Yeah.
And so they promised it would be for 18 months. And we ended up coming to the U.S. And my family has been here for now 22 years.
Did you have siblings?
Yep. I've got a baby brother and a big brother.
Were they born here? Was the younger one born here? Or?
Yep. The younger one was. Older one was not.
Okay. So you went to New York?
Yep.
New York City?
Yep. No, Long Island.
Okay.
Yeah.
How was that? What kind of culture shock did
culture
you experience?
Culture shock. And I think people were like, oh, you speak English.
Yeah.
Which was a huge help. Some words do not translate well.
I'm going to talk about that later, yeah.
Yeah, I have a pretty funny story. But it was just a huge culture shock, like from the streetlights in our subdivision. You know, we moved from very rural community into the suburbs.
Yeah.
And that was just a huge culture shock. The lights on the street. Actually, my family once, we went for a walk at night, and it was winter, and my dad just got lost. We couldn't tell the houses apart, and we had to knock on a random door, and this kind person bundled our family into their car and drove us home.
Oh.
Probably think my parents were insane that they got lost. The school bus was a whole new phenomenon for my parents.
Oh, yeah. Who needs a school bus in a village of 100
people?
Yeah, because
we would either walk or, you know, get driven, but it wasn't very far. Even the concept of homework. I mean, I really didn't have any in the UK.
Because you didn't?
Not really. I mean, maybe a tiny bit, but we didn't have backpacks or anything like that. We had these little cloth bags.
Mm-hmm.
They were kind of like a child's briefcase, but you would only use them at school.
Oh.
We wouldn't take them home. Hmm. And I think probably because there was a history piece there, even if we weren't doing it in my generation, but typically you would go home and there were farm chores or chores you had to do.
Right.
So you weren't doing homework, and certainly not to the level that they do here in the United States.
Oh.
And I was actually quite lucky because we were only supposed to be here for 18 months. So my parents were all about, you know, have the American experience. Who needs homework? You know, we're here to explore an adventure. So I had a pretty pretty good time with that.
What was your image of the United States before you came here, if any?
I think because I was so young, I didn't have too much of a concept.
Okay.
The only thing I knew is, I don't know if my parents had spoken about it. I have no idea how it got into my head. But I remember hearing about Al Capone.
Al Capone.
And thinking about gangsters and that New York sounded very scary and big. And and I didn't really understand like Long Island versus New York City.
Right.
And what that was like until we came and we looked at houses and I was like, it's an island. We're going to live on an island.
Well, England is an island.
England
too.
Is a big island. I really didn't have too much of a preconceived notion other than it was big.
What was that first day at school like in Long Island?
Oh, I remember being horrible.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I mean, it's always hard to be the new kid.
Yeah. Did you come in the middle of the school year or in the summer?
We came in January.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I'm going to this massive elementary school. And I've never
From a school of 12 to hundreds.
And we had to rotate between teachers.
Yeah.
And I'd never done that before. I'd never had a locker.
Oh,
I didn't have a backpack at my former school.
Yeah.
So it all just felt so scary. And my fifth grade teacher wasn't particularly kind or helpful.
Oh.
And I remember she put me in the front of the class and she's like, this is Helen. She's from England. And of course, the first thing everyone noticed was my accent.
Yeah.
Which now is much less.
Yeah.
But me at 10 was quite strong.
Yeah.
And I just remember being so embarrassed.
Oh.
And not knowing what to do.
Oh, gosh. At that age, kids would just want to hide in the back. They don't want to be on public display like that.
I also really struggled because I was used to a school uniform.
Oh.
And then here, there wasn't one.
Mm.
So I decided I would make one. So I just wore the exact same sweater every day and the same pair of jeans.
Mm.
And that didn't help me make any friends. Because people are like, don't you have other clothes? What's wrong with you? Why are you dressing like that? So that didn't help either. I also didn't know what Twizzlers were. That was a problem.
How many kids were in a class in your fifth grade class? I know you rotated classes, but I'm a lot larger than
it was
in England.
Probably 30 in the class.
30.
So then
wow.
3, 6, 90 in the the fifth grade.
Yeah.
But it was much bigger.
Were there any other immigrant kids there besides you or ESL?
I'm sure there were, but I don't remember meeting them or hanging out. You know, I think it was 10 years old is a hard transition time, and I remember just kind of getting into a little bubble of one and. I've always been an avid reader, so that was my avenue.
Yeah, me too. When I was nine, I'm third grade. I guess it was third grade. Eight, maybe it was eight. We moved in March.
Mm.
And I still haven't forgiven my parents for that, because that I, what you're talking about, I can relate to that so well. And that was just in the same city. Not even the same country, but the same city, different school. It's just – it's traumatic for kids.
Yeah, it's a huge rupture. Mm,
yeah. Well, you I guess you met some nice kids and made some friends along the way. How did that play out?
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty good. You know, people were always curious and nice. And I think people really did try to kind of take our family in and make sure my parents felt welcome.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know about other people who are new to a country, but you're kind of in, but you're always kind of a little bit out as well.
Yeah.
And especially because everything, especially in my younger years, was that we were leaving. There was always an end point. We were only there for 18 months. And so it became hard to make friends because you didn't feel like it was permanent. And then my parents always kept adding on to the contract.
Oh, really?
So you have that feeling of, how long are we here for?
Yeah, gosh. Well, you never did go back then, I guess. You're still here.
So. I'm still here. I did go back in my 20s. I went and lived. I had the extraordinary luck to live, not study, but to live at Oxford University.
But not study?
Not study. I was there with my partner at the time, and he was there on a master's degree program.
Oh, okay.
So I was allowed, as a UK citizen, I was allowed to live there.
Oh,
so that was brilliant.
The best of both worlds.
Oh, yeah. None of the work and all the fun.
Wow. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit. You said that you had some funny stories about language.
I do.
I got some funny stories, too. What were some of the examples that you found?
So one of them that I got in big trouble for, my parents got called to the school for, was that me at 10, I asked my teacher for a rubber.
I've heard this before. I've heard somebody else tell that story.
Yeah, and I got in pretty big trouble. And I was just trying to explain. I needed an eraser.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't know the right word.
Yeah.
And my fifth grade teacher was not very kind in
being helpful
with that.
Oh, that same fifth grade teacher,
Same
huh?
fifth grade teacher.
Yeah.
She also had a huge problem with the way I spell mum or color.
Oh.
So obviously we use a U.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 10.
Yeah.
And so I'm, you know, I've been taught to spell mum a certain way and color a certain way and different English words. And she wasn't very kind in letting that slide. And my parents had a lot of meetings being like, look, we're just here on a temporary basis. She's not, for my parents, it was she's not becoming American.
Right.
But she's also not spelling it incorrectly. She's spelling it correctly.
Right.
Is it a big deal if she spells mum with a U?
I think it was George Bernard Shaw that said, England and America are two countries separated by the same language. You ever heard that before? Because I don't have any embarrassing stories, but like, I think what we call a biscuit, you call a cookie and vice versa.
Yeah.
And we say parking lot, you say car park.
Yeah, or the boot.
The boot and the bonnet for the trunk and the hood of the car.
Mm-hmm.
I taught English in Japan a while back, and there were a number of British teachers there on the same program with me. And so I got to meet a lot of them. And I learned words like skint.
Yeah.
Which means in American English, broke, like no money.
Yeah, I'm pretty skint.
I'm pretty skint. And they'd say brill.
Oh, for brilliant.
I didn't know that. What does brill mean, brilliant? But I remember they introduced me to something which I still like, which is Marmite.
Oh, I love Marmite.
Marmite is like Vegemite, right?
Marmite's better.
But I agree, but people might be more familiar with Vegemite. It's like, can you tell what it's made of?
Or to describe it, it's kind of like black tar.
It's what it looks like, but that's not what it tastes like.
It's kind of like a luxurious salt.
Very salty.
Very salty. I like it on white bread with a lot of butter and Marmite, and I like to squish it.
Yeah.
So I don't like fluffy bread. I like very dense bread. I'm gluten-free now, but when I could eat it.
Yeah.
But it's very relaxing.
It's made from yeast.
I think it's just a yeast paste. It looks horrible.
It does, but it's good.
Bad.
I liked it the first time I tried it.
It's comforting.
Yeah, it is. It is. Okay, so your 18 months turned into much longer. Did your are your parents still here?
My father is. He's in New York, and my mom eventually went back to the UK.
Okay, so he just kept renewing his contract for.
Yeah, it was always in like chunks of time, and we would always have like a family meeting of what we're going to do and we're going to stay. And
did you get a vote?
I don't know if my parents would have operated with a democracy, but they let us talk about it, and they were very concerned with they knew that it meant that we were far away from our grandparents and our friends, and also I think they understood what it was to be a young person trying to figure out how to fit in and that it's hard.
Well, did you ultimately like complete your primary and secondary school in New York?
Yep. So I finished. I went all the way through actually grad school in New York.
Is that right?
Which is great. Yeah. I don't know why it didn't occur to me at the time to go back. But it just seemed, you know, I went to a SUNY school and then I went to a SUNY graduate program. Uh-huh. And New York, you know, it became my second home. It's been very good to me.
Did you continue to live in Long Island then with your family while you were going through school?
Yeah, I was when I went to undergraduate, I went to Binghamton University.
Oh, okay.
In upstate New York, so uh-huh. that I was away for. But graduate school, I'd actually already gotten my first job in a Holocaust museum. And the museum was wonderful. They said I could pursue my master's at night and I could keep my job during the day, which was wonderful. So I lived at home. Saved a lot of money, which I would advise to anybody out there thinking about a master's. And I was able to keep my museum job and pursue a degree in history specializing in Holocaust and genocide while living with my dad.
The Holocaust Museum in New York?
Mm-hmm.
New York City?
Yep.
Okay.
Not New York City, Long Island.
Long Island, okay.
Yep.
And then so you went – the high school you attended was in the same town where your elementary school was. So you
yep.
probably got to know some of those kids fairly well over the years.
Yeah, some of them I was able to get to know and mm-hmm. make some friendships, and which was really nice. And people were always wonderful to me.
That's good. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think it's time for our first break. So why don't we just stop here for a minute. We're going to come back in just a minute and pick up the story. You mentioned the Holocaust Museum. So I want to talk a lot about that because that's a big part of your story. So you're listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Walking around the room singing stormy weather at 57 Mount Pleasant Street. Well, it's the same room, but everything's different. You can fight the sleep, but not the dream.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by Arnell's Hardwoods. For all of your laminate and hardwood flooring needs, call them at 314-397-3252.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by the Indoor Comfort Team. For all of your heating and cooling needs, call the Indoor Comfort Team at 314-230-9542.
This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Welcome back. We're talking with Helen Turner from England, originally from England. Been here, I think you've been here longer than you lived in England, though, mm-hmm. altogether.
I know. It's a horrible tipping point
yeah.
when you reach that.
Yeah. And your accent, I think you lost quite a bit of mm-hmm. your accent.
Yeah.
When you go back, does it come back to you?
Oh, yes.
Does it?
Even if I just talk to my dad on the phone or my mother on the phone, or if I watch an English TV show,
mm-hmm.
Or even sometimes like us bringing up certain phrases or
yeah.
even thinking about my childhood,
yeah,
you can slip back into it really
yeah,
easily. And
I'm sure.
When I'm very tired, it's also very English.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that. Okay, you mentioned that you were working at a Holocaust museum in Long Island
mm-hmm.
and studying, I guess, genocide studies? Or
yeah, Holocaust and genocide.
How did you get interested in that?
Yeah, and I think it is a really interesting story. I learned about the Holocaust at a very young age from a family friend. And I was, you know, she explained it to me so gently. She was from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And she just said that during the Holocaust, one group of people said that another group of people didn't deserve to live.
Mm-hmm.
And we can never live like that. All human beings deserve to be seen and safe and heard.
Mm-hmm.
And she explained it to me. I'm about 7 years old at this time.
Oh, that young. You were still
very
in England then.
Oh, yeah. Still in England. And I was just absolutely captivated. And I think I've always really been drawn to people who've been silenced or people whose stories aren't told. And for me, I was just so captivated with the story of the Holocaust and how many people's voices have been silenced. And it became something I really... I sort of gently pursued. Coming to the United States actually really helped because I found it much more robustly represented in the curriculum than it was in the UK, in my mm. experience. Mm. I know it's different now. And I had a teacher who was just really encouraging. And
not the fifth grade teacher.
Not the fifth grade teacher. No, a different one, my ninth grade teacher, Mr. Shelley. And I just decided I wanted to study history. And I got very, very lucky that my parents were supportive and allowed me to do that. And I had no idea what kind of career it would be. I just wanted to uncover more of the story.
Wow.
And so I graduated with an undergraduate from Binghamton University in history, specializing in Holocaust and genocide. And then I got my very first internship at the Holocaust Memorial and Tolerance Center in Nassau County.
Wow. By this time, you realized you were going to be staying in this country, I guess, right?
Yeah, we hadn't talked about it too much, but my dad was definitely staying. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see a clear path to go back to the UK. Mm-hmm. So at that time, I was on a green card. Mm-hmm. And so if you go back to your – if you leave the United States, you have to return within a certain number of months,
right,
in order to keep your green card valid. So it became like, I don't want to lose the green card.
Yeah.
So how do I kind of – play both sides.
Yeah.
And in that moment in time, it made sense to pursue school here.
Okay. What was your job at the museum up there in Long Island?
Sure. I began as an intern, and I did every job in the education department, and I left as the director of education.
Did you?
I did.
Okay. Was that a very large museum compared to?
No, it was much smaller than the one here in St. Louis.
Okay.
Staff of about between 5 and 7, depending on the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there. I had a gap in the middle, but I worked there for about 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah, I loved it.
Did you?
Yeah. It was such a beautiful space. And one of the survivors I had met in the 9th grade, at sort of Holocaust Day, Werner Reich. I had met him when I was in the 9th grade, and I shook his hand and I cried and said, you know, your story is amazing. You've changed my life, which happens to him all the time.
Mm.
But then when I got to my job, you know, 10 or so years later, someone told me that a man was speaking in the auditorium. I should go and listen. And I go in and it's Werner.
Mm.
And we developed a lifelong friendship. And he was an extraordinary teacher and man. And he died last year, and he was an incredible person in my life.
Were there many Holocaust survivors living up in the New York area at the time?
There were. I was so lucky. I think I came in right before we had a large wave of deaths.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I met them all when they were maybe mid-80s, and they just adopted me and loved me, and they're the best people I know.
Mm-hmm.
They've lived such incredible lives, and mm-hmm. I'm so privileged to know both the pain and the joy of their lives.
Yeah. Okay, and then how did it come about that you wound up in St. Louis then?
Sure. So I was director of education all through the pandemic, running the museum virtually through my attic. Yeah, I lived in this amazing attic apartment, which I loved, in a 1920s house. And with the pandemic, the museum obviously shut down.
Uh-huh.
And I became the only full-time staff member left on staff for a short period of time. And so I started running virtual tours from my laptop.
Virtual tours, huh?
I went into the museum right as the pandemic, as we were closing, and I photographed everything in the museum.
Wow.
And then I made a PowerPoint, and I live-talked people through the exhibition.
That's a great idea.
It was one of those things of kind of, we got to do something, so here
we
are. So I did that for a while, and then, you know, in my life, you know, my personal life changed, and I've been at the museum for a long time, and it was a beautiful experience. But I also wanted to see what else was out there. So I started Googling.
There's life past the Hudson River.
Yeah, there's other things out there. And I started, you know, searching and just kind of, you know, reaching out as you do when you're looking for different opportunities. And I saw the job advertisement for St. Louis.
Mm.
But I saw that they were rebuilding a new Holocaust museum. And that is so rare in my field. Most of our museums were built in the 90s. So people do renovations or mm-hmm. things like that, but to come in at the project where it was when I joined just felt like the opportunity of a lifetime. And I got to be honest, I'd been to St. Louis once before on a road trip of Route 66. It wasn't the best of impressions. And I was like, I'm never going back to St. Louis. And the joke now is that I got so excited. I applied for the job. I was all, you know, ready to roll. And my dad asked me, where is it? And I said, I don't know. I forgot to look. I just applied.
Seriously?
Yeah. It was such a wonderful job. I was like, I'll go wherever. Uh-huh. And then I realized it was St. Louis.
Oh, my gosh.
But St. Louis has been a wonderful home.
Yeah.
It's been great to me. But I would have moved anywhere to do this.
So you applied for – you're currently the director of education.
I am,
local,
yes.
And that's the job that you came here to start.
Yep. That was the job I pursued. And,
okay.
And I was very lucky.
How long did that interview process take? Was this during the pandemic still?
It was right at the tail end of the pandemic. So still masking. People hadn't – I had just been vaccinated when I came here to interview. But it took about 6 months, soup to nuts.
Wow.
So – and I really appreciated that. I think the museum was looking for something very specific. Mm-hmm. And I think they really wanted to make sure they got the right person. Mm-hmm. And I was also looking for something very specific. Mm-hmm. I was really leaving my family. My father still lives on Long Island. I was leaving a job that I adored and loved.
Yeah.
To move somewhere where I knew absolutely no one.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah. So for me, it had to be the right fit. And wow. I had to feel really good about the project. And they also were very gracious and gave me the time to wrap up my job on Long Island. I love that place so much, and I didn't want to leave it in a lurch or anything. I wanted to fully set a foundation before I left. And the museum here was extremely gracious and kind in letting me do that.
That's great. And so you mentioned that the local Holocaust Museum was renovated itself, or it was actually a whole new building, right?
A whole new building. I would actually call it a reimagination.
Reimagination.
Of what it could be.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. Tell us where it's located in the city, first of all, for people that might not
know. Sure. It's on the corner of Limburg and Schutz, mm-hmm. Right opposite the J. We are connected to the Jewish Federation, mm-hmm. who's our parent. And, you know, it's an extraordinary building. We used to be in the Jewish Federation building. It was an extraordinary museum. It's been there since 1994. And truly, when I came on board, there had been talks in prior years that they were just getting too big for the space. Mm. There was so much interest in this topic, so many schools coming to visit. Mm-hmm. I think in the beginning they were going to do a refresh of the exhibition, but the interest was just so overwhelming and people were so encouraging.
Wow.
That it turned into a complete reimagination.
Yeah.
And so now we're our own facility, still connected to Jewish Federation, both physically and also we have so many community and wonderful ties with Jewish Federation. We wouldn't be where we are without them. And we were able to become our own 501c3 nonprofit.
Oh, okay.
And we opened on November 2nd of 2022.
I've been to the museum before the reimagination, as you called it, and I thought it was excellent. I did go to the museum in New York, I guess in D.C., Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., but it was so crowded that day that I went. I couldn't even see anything. There were like five or six people in front of me for each exhibition. So I really, really liked. I don't know if like is the right word, but I was really impressed with our local Holocaust Museum. And I haven't been. I'm ashamed to say I haven't been since you've reopened, so I'm looking forward to doing that. One of the things that's new is what you call the Impact Lab, right? Mm-hmm. What is that all about?
Oh, Impact Lab, I feel very proud of Impact Lab. When you talk about Holocaust education, so often people, they go through the exhibition, they learn about this horrific time in history, and then they're usually left with some sort of happy video that says, now you know, go out there, prevent genocide, stand up to bigotry and hatred and anti-Semitism. And that's just so much to ask of a 13-year-old, a 33-year-old, a 66-year-old. What does that mean? And so Impact Lab is really the answer to that question. And we want to be really clear with people. When we say anti-Semitism, what does that look like today? I think often people are waiting for, the person with the swastika yelling Heil Hitler. Mm-hmm. Anti-Semitism rarely presents like that. It often presents with discrimination in the workplace, with stereotypes, with, slurs. What does that look like and how do we respond? And so Impact Lab is a physical space. It's a brave space where you can practice actually responding. It's not just about anti-Semitism. It looks at racism, sexism, all different forms of discrimination. But it keeps them very rooted in reality, of who you are as an individual. We all react differently. And also the reality of how these things present themselves. We want people to feel empowered and not like they're being told that, the world is so broken, but that they're being told that things in the world are broken. Mm-hmm. How do we work together to fix it?
Have you gotten some feedback about that from school groups or
we just have,
visitors?
Yeah, we've had some wonderful groups in. We did a whole bunch of pilots because we want to make sure that obviously we're hitting the mark and mm-hmm. people are understanding the message. And the feedback has been breathtaking. Mm-hmm. People saying, they're thanking us for the space, for the opportunity that they've been able to learn and grow, mm-hmm. But also that it's hard. It's hard to look at our world and to look at ourselves and mm-hmm. say, my goodness, we do have some things to do. Mm-hmm. But also what a lovely opportunity to talk about what we can do.
Mm-hmm. Are we seeing an uptick in anti-Semitism in the last, 5-10 years?
I mean, I think yes. To be frank, I think there are certainly more incidents. I and the museum are being asked to respond to a lot more incidents. So I think on the one hand, I do think you have a rise in anti-Semitism. But I think it's also coupled with what I hope is more people feeling empowered to report anti-Semitism. I think things that people might have been embarrassed or frightened to let the authorities know about, they're giving voice to. I think that the authorities are taking anti-Semitism very seriously from every interaction I've had with law enforcement. And so I think it's probably a little bit of both. But what it's showing me is that we are still grappling with anti-Semitism. And that is the undeniable fact.
What are some other new things in the reimagined museum besides the Impact Lab? Anything else that was not there before?
Sure. I mean, I think we've really tried to look at the most modern scholarship on the Holocaust. You know, people sometimes say to me, you know, what could there possibly be that's new? But, you know, scholars are always debating, you know, how to represent things, how to talk about this history, updated statistics, updated language, how we talk about this history. And so the museum was extremely thoughtful. We engaged with five scholars, four of them all based in St. Louis, one based in the UK, to put together the script or the words in the museum and the images. And when I say the process was long, it was.
I bet.
But we had some brilliant minds thoughtfully crafting how to make sure that this is the most current Holocaust museum that we could build. And so I'm very proud of that. And I think also just the way that we're telling the stories. Our museum is extremely unique in that it's telling the stories of St. Louis Holocaust survivors, and it is their voices that carry. We have a strong narrative, which I think is really lovely, and we're a very personal museum, which leaves you with a feeling. This history is not just about names and dates and facts. It's about people.
How many Holocaust survivors are living in St. Louis now? Do you know?
That's a great question. Currently, I mean, we're really not too sure. We have a small core that engages with the museum of maybe 20. But of course, there might be survivors out there who don't engage with the museum or don't want to identify that way. But we know that when we began the museum project, the reimagination, we had identified about 300 people. By the time we opened, we had identified about 800. And now we're well over the 900 mark. So that's not currently living, but it's people who were survivors, came here and settled in St. Louis for a period of time.
So they're not all living today.
Not all living today, but the population and their descendants and the community that's here is really vibrant and beautiful.
Are a lot of them docents or volunteers with the museum?
Yes, many people are really engaged in the museum as museum educators, as speakers, as facilitators, as welcome desk. And I would say that to anybody listening, if you're interested, there's a spot for anyone at the museum.
And you said the stories that you're telling are the stories of local residents, right?
Yes, and we were very clear on that directive, that it's our local survivors whose voices – it's just our job to provide a platform for them. And so I think it's a really personal museum that
way. So important. Okay, I think we're ready for one more short break, and then we'll come back and pick this up a little bit longer. You're listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Everywhere you go, always take the weather with you. Everywhere you go, always take the weather. Everywhere you go, always take the weather with you.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by Samim Afghan Restaurant, featuring traditional Afghan cuisine and conveniently located on Manchester Road in the Grove.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you by Hacking Law, for individuals who want to come and stay in the U.S. Hacking Law fights for immigrants every day. Visit them at hackingimmigrationlaw.com.
Everywhere you go, always take the weather with you.
This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Welcome back. We're talking with Helen Turner, originally from England. She is a director of education for the St. Louis Holocaust Museum. Is that the official title?
The St. Louis Kaplan-Feldman Holocaust Museum.
Okay. St. Louis Kaplan-Feldman Holocaust Museum. What is your role exactly? You're the director of education. So what's a typical day for you?
Oh, boy.
Or is there a typical
yeah,
day?
Yeah, so I guess a typical day, I usually start my day saying good morning to everybody. I'm welcoming the education team and going over who's going to be in the building. So as director of education, I'm responsible for all of our student groups, our adult groups, general public, anybody who engages with our educational materials. Mm-hmm. And so I really try and make sure I know what's happening in the building. We are a much bigger building now, a much busier building, so making sure I know what's happening. And then the rest of my job is really about developing both curriculum but also relationships. I see myself as really the connector between the museum and so much of the community in saying, how can we work with you? How can we work together? Mm-hmm. Helping teachers. There's a new Holocaust mandate that's coming into effect this year for pilot schools, next year for all of Missouri.
Oh.
And so right now my focus is really on meeting superintendents, teachers, admins. How do we help you? Mm-hmm. You know, a mandate can be both a wonderful thing but also a new challenge. Mm-hmm. And we want to show teachers that they're not alone, that we're here to help them and to be with them. Mm-hmm. So I really spend a lot of my time talking to people, which is my favorite thing to do.
Yeah, you're good at it.
Thank you.
A lot of school groups come in still.
Yes.
They're, I guess, from all over the state, maybe Illinois, everywhere.
Even further afield.
Really?
I mean, I have been shocked. You know, some of our student groups are really driving 3-4 hours to get to us, which I think just shows how important this education is and what a resource we can be for the region. Mm-hmm. I've been wowed and delighted by the people that we've met, by the students that have engaged with us. Mm-hmm. And it really has been from all across the state. But yeah, from Illinois, from Arkansas, we even had a group from Minnesota.
Really?
So they really are coming from all over.
How many people usually come for a typical day?
It depends. You know, we've been experimenting with summer hours, which are new for us.
Uh-huh.
So that's been a little bit on the quieter side. But as I said during the commercial break, we had almost 100 people yesterday. Mm. So I think the heat's in our favor.
Yeah, something to do
We have
inside.
Very good air conditioning.
Yeah. Oh, that's good to know. Now, I think because you're not able to predict how many people are going to come in and people might have – it doesn't hold so many people at one time. Mm-hmm. But you're suggesting that people kind of – reserve a spot through your website?
Definitely, yep. So you can go to our website, which is www.stlholocaustmuseum.org. And we do encourage you to buy tickets online, just so that you can reserve your spot. It won't be overcrowded. You can make sure that you have time and space. Mm-hmm. This is a museum you don't want to hustle through.
Right.
And we want to give you the space to reflect.
How much time do you think a person should allow to make sure that it's a meaningful visit? How much time?
Sure. So in the museum, we've got three things. We've got swimmers, skimmers, and deep divers. So you've got some people who are just there for your surface level experience.
Got it.
You could walk it through in 20 minutes.
Okay.
I would say your average visitor, about 1.5 to 2 hours.
Wow.
But your deep diver, your person who wants to look and listen to everything in the exhibition, between 3 and 4.
Mm.
Depends on your interest level.
Yeah.
And that's why we always encourage people. You can come for one visit, but you can come again. And because the museum is full of oral histories and videos, you could come again and have a completely different experience.
Right, right. So there's audiovisual displays too?
Oh, we have a lot of tech in the exhibition. Different interactive maps, films. We have these incredible things called activated artifacts. And this is where you go up to an artifact case and you would hover your hand and a survivor will speak to you about what's in the case.
Oh, local survivors?
Yep. It's all their oral testimonies, which is incredible.
Are some of the displays from the previous museum?
Yep. So a lot of the items are from the previous museum, a lot of the images. But we really took this opportunity to go through our collection. Mm-hmm. And say, what were the stories we weren't able to tell because of space limitations before, and how do we do that now?
I remember a great map you had there in the old museum with locations of all the camps, and that kind of put things in perspective. I thought, is that still on display?
We actually did a reimagining of that, and we've made it into a digital interactive.
Oh.
So when you hover your hand, it shows you the entirety of Europe, and it layers in camps, ghettos, killing sites, killing centers, and railway lines.
Wow.
And it's really, I think it's an extraordinary tool to show the scope and scale of the Holocaust and how much collaboration there was between different companies, countries.
Yeah, the companies, that's something that a lot of people, I didn't think about.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the railway lines, yeah. The industrial companies that participated in the utilization of enslaved labor.
Yeah.
It really, the Holocaust could not have happened unless many millions of people collaborated.
Right. Gosh. What are the hours of the museum? You said there's summer hours now. What?
Yep. So summer hours. So we are open to the public Mondays. And sorry, every day but Tuesday, that's an easy way to say it, until Labor Day. And then Labor Day, we close Mondays and Tuesdays to the public, and that's to give space to our school groups. Mm. But we're open all 7 days a week. So you can book to come to the museum if you're a member of the public, Wednesday through Sunday.
And what are the hours?
And the hours are from 10 until 4:30.
Okay. How many Holocaust museums are there in the United States now? Do you know?
That's a great question. You know, I think you have to kind of define what we mean by Holocaust, either museum or center. Mm-hmm. Some are one-man shows, and then some are institutions like ourselves. Mm-hmm. I think there's about 22 museums of comparable size to the St. Louis Museum.
Okay.
But there's a you know, quite a number. I'm part, and so is the museum, part of the Association of Holocaust Organizations. Mm. So we gather annually. And we're a pretty good crowd. So there's usually almost one in every state, but not quite in every state.
Okay.
Yeah, at least something, either a research center or a library or a one-man show of some sort in most states.
Do you find these in Europe too?
Yes, there's a lot in Europe. And especially with Europe, you have the physical sites.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the museum was just on a European heritage trip. So we spent...
Yeah. You said you were
traveling.
How was that?
Oh, it was extraordinary.
Where did you go?
We went to Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic. There's another country in there. It's a little bit of a blur.
Were you visiting camps, former campsites and other museums too?
Yeah, we were. We went to museums, former campsites, former ghettos. It's my second time doing a trip like that, but every time you do it, it completely moves and shakes you.
You went to the Warsaw Ghetto?
Yeah, we went to Warsaw.
How is that memorialized now, if at all? Is it?
There's only a very tiny portion of the wall that is left. Warsaw was leveled.
Right.
But we went to the Poland Museum, which was extraordinary.
I bet.
Absolutely extraordinary. And to be in Warsaw, to be in Łódź, I mean, these spaces are so layered with history and also with people who are currently grappling with it.
Yeah.
And I was floored.
Do you know how many Jewish people are living in Poland now? Because I think they suffered maybe the greatest losses.
I mean, the population has severely declined since pre-Holocaust. But the Jewish people that are there, especially when we were in Krakow, it was a really vibrant community.
Mm.
The Krakow JCC was extraordinary. The work they're doing is amazing.
Wow.
We had the privilege of actually going to Friday night services in Krakow after coming back from Auschwitz. And we were surrounded by about 200 Israeli students dancing and singing.
Really?
And I've never been to something more spiritually moving.
What an experience that was. Wow. I remember in the previous, museum before you reimagined, there was a monthly film series. I don't know if that was part of the museum or part of the JCC in general, but is that still happening now?
Well, sure. That's a great question. So there was a monthly film series. Again, we're kind of reimagining that to see what it looks like. So we did just do a film last month on Big Sonia, who's a Holocaust survivor. She lives in Kansas City. She's extraordinary. But we are hoping to bring more films as we build out our programming.
Okay.
And we are really trying to build a robust calendar for 2024.
That would all be on your website, I guess?
Yes, it will.
Give us the website one more time.
Sure. It's www.stlholocaustmuseum.org.
Okay. I just have a few kind of general questions for you, if you don't mind. Things that I've wondered about, like, what is the difference between the United Kingdom and Great Britain?
Oh, dear. Hit me with a hard one.
It's United, hard for you.
My understanding, and all my Brits out there, I'm sorry if I garble it, but the United Kingdom constitutes, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, and then England, whereas Great Britain, I believe, is more like the British Isles. So Britain and the British Isles is my understanding, but I'm very okay to be being really wrong.
Okay. Maybe this is above your pay grade, but I'm curious about this too. Scotland has had a couple of referenda trying to decide whether they want to become independent, and it never quite made it. Do you think that's ever going to happen? Will Scotland ever become like separate from
England? You know, I don't know. I mean, I was there for one of the referendum votes.
Were you?
And I was there for Brexit as well. It was the first thing I ever voted in, which was exciting.
Mm.
I voted to remain. But, you know, I think Scotland, you know, I think Brexit really changed everything in England. I remember when it happened and it felt devastating.
Well, the Scottish people were more in favor of staying, right?
Yeah.
Whereas
the British... Britain split.
Yeah.
And of course, now Scotland is sort of tangled up in England's decision.
Right.
And so I think the need for Scotland to be its own country, I think the want is certainly there. And I could see with as everything unfolds with Brexit, Scotland definitely looking to separate again. And I understand their want for independence.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to see where it goes and what happens with Scottish politics.
Yeah.
So I know there's some bit of a pickle with Nicola Sturgeon right now.
Yeah.
But I think they will probably try and separate again.
Mm-hmm. We recently had the coronation of King Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just such a foreign concept to most of us in the United States to have a royal family. I guess some people look at celebrities as royalty here sometimes maybe. But do you think that this – I mean, do you think – I guess I have a couple questions.
Mm-hmm.
Do most British citizens like the fact that there is a royal family and are kind of proud of that? And secondly, do you think it will continue into the future as a thing, even though it seems kind of old-fashioned?
I think it's a great question. I mean, I grew up with a grandmother who loved the Queen because the Queen had drove an ambulance during the war, and my grandma and her were very similar ages, and she became like the voice of the people.
I've heard
And my grandma loved her, and I felt not a kinship. I think that's a bit too grand, but I really respected the Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was devastated when she died.
Mm.
I was actually at the museum. I was doing a training. So I'm talking to a live audience, and one of the museum educators came up to me and put a note in my hand, and it just said, "The Queen is dead."
Mm.
And they actually held a moment of silence, which I thought was really beautiful for them to do for me as a new member to the community.
Mm.
I went to her funeral.
Did you?
It was live streamed at the London Tea Room. And so I went at 4 o'clock in the morning to the funeral, which was really powerful to sit there with, I'm assuming, a bunch of other expats and cry and see that. But I think with the way the monarchy's going, I think there is a lot of resentment in the country.
Mm.
I think, and still just hearsay from my relatives, but life in England is a little tough at the moment. There are shortages of eggs and tomatoes, and I think the war in Ukraine is making things a lot more stressful. Brexit is really stressful. And so I think people see a family with tremendous wealth and they wonder sort of, is there still a space for the monarchy?
Mm.
The monarchy does generate tremendous wealth for the UK in tourism and things that we sell.
Mm.
I remember when Kate and William got married. I mean, there was all kinds of plates you could buy. But I'm not sure where I'll go with Charles.
Mm.
But I am curious about William and Kate. I like them a lot. I think they could be a good face for the monarchy and bring it into the modern era.
Right.
So I think there almost is this love-hate relationship where people are okay to kind of slam them when they want to, but I think they'd miss them if they were there.
I agree. I think that sounds right. Do you go back frequently to visit?
I haven't in a while because of the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
but and my boss knows this, so I can say it on the air. I'm going back in April for my cousin's wedding.
Okay.
And it'll be the first time my whole family is back in the UK since 2015.
Nice.
And I cannot wait. I cannot wait.
What do you miss most about Britain or England here?
Probably two things. The first would be the food. I love English food. I love it.
Okay.
Sausages and chips and all the chocolate that I like.
Do you know the English shop in St. Charles?
Yes. My brother and I almost bought them out.
Did you? Yeah. I go there all the time too.
So English food I miss. And then it might sound silly, but I really miss knowing a reference. Here, again, because I was always going to leave.
Mm.
There's so many references I don't know. Whereas in England, if you talk to me about something,
mm-hmm.
I might have watched that TV show, especially if it's from the 80s or the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Or I know that street that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Did you watch EastEnders?
Sure did. But there's just something about home.
Yeah.
It'll always be home.
No matter where. Yeah.
Yeah, but I miss it tremendously.
Yeah. Even though you've been here twice as long as you were there. It's still home.
It is still home. And I went back every summer when I was a kid. And I, as I said, I lived there in my 20s mm-hmm. for a short period. But it is always home. And whenever I hear that Ed Sheeran song, I think Castle on the Hill, I cry every time I listen to it because he's talking about home.
Yeah. What's the best and worst thing about living in America? Final question.
I'll start with the worst. Worst thing about living in America for me, probably the reliability on cars.
Mm.
You have to, especially in St. Louis, which I love.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of cars.
Yep.
And in the UK, you live in a village, you can walk to everything. Your whole world
or
is there.
Bicycle.
And then, yeah, or bicycle. And then there's a great train or a good bus and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So that'd be the hardest thing for me is the car culture.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing about the United States, I think for me, was my access to education.
Mm.
I don't think I would have gone to university if I'd been in the UK. It just wasn't something that was in the world that I lived in.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, there's such a college culture that I was able to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so grateful for the educational opportunities I experienced here. I would not be the person I am or have the job I have if I hadn't moved to the U.S.
Interesting. Okay, thank you. Give us one more time the museum's website.
Sure. www.stlholocaustmuseum.org.
Okay. Well, Helen, thank you very much for this interesting conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And I encourage listeners to visit the museum. It's really worth a trip. It's I don't know how to describe it, but it's something important that we should all see.
Definitely.
Okay. And thank you for listening. You've been listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.